Hello, everyone, and welcome to another expert interview session for the Innovation and Creativity Summit 2017. I'm very happy once again to have Michael Graber with me. Michael is the co-founder of the Southern Growth Studio, the vice president of innovation at Hunter Fans, and also the author of Going Electric. Michael, it's good to have you again.
Thank you, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here.
So for people who don't know about you and the work that you do or what Southern Growth Studio does, could you give us a bit of a background as to how you got involved in innovation?
Well, I was born, I'm just kidding. Certainly. I started out my career as a poetry professor and was allergic to business, but had kids rather young, and so ended up moving into business. And what I found first in writing and editing, and then in user experience, and then in creative direction, and then in brand strategy, and then in management consultancy, is that I had this itch. And this itch was what was driving the engine of business. And ultimately, it was our creativity. And then the question for me became, how do you make the most impact? And what I saw by using innovation methods, but also skills that can push innovation methods through enterprises, people skills, diplomacy skills, soft skills, you're able to get the biggest impact. And so that became my quest. And I also have a very romantic sense of what innovation can do at an enterprise as well as in the world. So it's nice to see people really coming alive by using these methods and bringing their full humanity to work, and then going and do service work in their communities in the world using these methods.
And how does that translate to the work that Southern Growth Studio does?
So we founded the Southern Growth Studio almost 10 years ago. And what we found was that more and more companies were giving lip service to innovation. Maybe they had a board mandate to do it, or a corporate mandate, or they just thought that stimulating their troops from the bottom up would be a good thing. But it was at almost the first generation of when innovation was going mass, so to speak. There was a lot of press in Fortune and Forbes, et cetera. And most people saw it as a failed experiment. They may have crowdsourced something, they may have had an ideation session with their team, or even some ideation software, and then they would immediately not know what to do with this influx of ideas, right? And they weren't basing the ideas even on insights from the field or insights from the people for whom they're solving problems, but rather they were just projecting what these tired old saws and agendas they've been carrying all these years anyway. So it's almost just a download rather than a true ideation that's based on insights. So the whole projects were aborted. And with the Southern Growth Studio, what we see now is that you have to truly embed innovation. And an innovation embedment requires two fundamental facets. The first is concepts, right? You have to come up with breakthrough ideas outside of the confines of the existing business model. And you have to do that in a way that generates new value for the firm. But by doing so, there's a paradox at hand. And that paradox is that by creating new value that's outside of the core business model, it's getting to adjacencies or further out. What happens is that if you don't work on the culture simultaneously, the cultural antibodies are going to flare up and attack all of the concepts with a vehemence, saying, you don't belong here. My budget's not tethered to you. We don't know how to distribute in this channel. It'll come up with 1,000 known and unknown reasons to attack the new thinking. So where the studio particularly plays is that after a company or a nonprofit has tried to, one, do innovation themselves and failed, secondly, they spent a lot of money going to some of the world-class innovation firms and ended up with what we call expensive door stoppers, stacks of concepts and insights, and they didn't know how to activate them. The studio can come in as a middle layer that can actually work with your team, train the methods, By doing so, we get into the culture crafting, letting the culture flex, the mindset of the place flex, to accept and embrace some of this new thinking about the business. Simultaneously using your people and a few of our own to generate these ideas, which is its own curative. So the mix of these two pieces, these fundamental cornerstones, the concepts, yes, of course, but you have to have the cultural receptivity to them, is how the studio helps embed innovation.
You mentioned there's some methodologies that you can use to actually help this culture. I'm sure a lot of people would love to hear about those. Could you give us some insight into, not all of them, but just some highlights of things that companies can try as far as methodologies to improve innovation culture goes?
Right. Well, it's been proven time and time again that the single most important factor in innovation success at an organization is executive championship. So you have to have the steering team or the C-level sign off and truly embrace and embody these pieces. They won't sign up on something like an innovation challenge with any sincerity if it conflicts with their corporate strategy. So we won't take on a client unless we can work directly with the executives and help the executives get an innovation strategy that dovetails with their corporate strategy. So there are lots of various methods we bring to bear. I'll just mention a few, as you said. The first is having the executives go through a session of identifying orthodoxies is very, very helpful. And the reason is that once they understand that their mental model of reality, their paradigm, what we like to call the inside-out view of the world, of how the business sees the world, is not reality itself. It's just one model. So once they're aware of that, they then are able to note their limiting behaviors and their own internal biases and can break that stronghold of that paradigm that they've created. It's become almost calcified in a sense, right? That becomes their culture, the blank way of how we make decisions here. But when they're able to detach and back up a little bit, they see that that lens is just one lens and there may be other lenses. Another is just to sort of really dive deeply into definition of words, right? Innovation. What does it mean? You know, it's like one of those scary words like creativity or strategy that means something different to everybody who hears it. But if we can help them generate their own definition, that goes a long way, right? There's certainly textbook definitions, but if they have to own it and understand it, typically the textbook definitions include it will give us some ownable value in the world, it's new value, it helps us leapfrog competition, and it also gives us sustainable competitive advantage. But there may be something particular to a place that needs to be added. For example, if it's a traditionally an engineering-led culture, then maybe adding a different criterion such as it must offer a superior consumer experience would be the right medicine in that case.
It's interesting you say that because just last year I was trying to get insights from many of the experts who were at this summit and some other ones who aren't as well on their view of what exactly is innovation from the innovation expert perspective. And what I found was every single person had a different definition that they used with their clients, and it just shows how broad this subject really is. And I think the overall definition that we came to after we analyzed everything was it's taking an idea and turning it into a solution that adds value to both the company and the customer. And I think that's something that quite often companies forget about. It's about the experience from the end customer that they see value in what's being produced.
That's true. Key point, the way I like to discuss it is when most people, especially executives who typically go to very good MBA schools, when they hear innovation process, all their preset filters hear the word process. And so I have to hold up two hands and give a visual demonstration like Austin Powers at that point. But where on one hand, when you hear the word process, you think immediately of the scientific management theory. It goes all the way back to the birth of the Industrial Revolution. So every bit of the word process, if you think of some of the examples, scientific management, Kaizen, Six Sigma, right? All of these things, I could name all of them, I've studied and taught some of these. They are all about process optimization, right? But they're all about taking what is and making it as optimized and well-run and cost-efficient as possible. But an innovation process, and I'm very careful to decouple the word process from the word innovation. So innovation is not about that type of optimization process, but rather it is about creating new value. And that's my definition. It creates net new value. And that value is both, as you very eloquently said, for whoever is using it and the organization itself.
What about when you come up to these process-driven senior people, though, and if their focus is on business as usual and keeping the ship afloat, and then you get some crazy bearded guy like yourself coming in and saying, no, you need to think about the future and innovation. Quite often there's a lot of reluctance there and a bit of fear about the unknown, about these risky new ideas compared to what they know works. How do you talk to people about that?
The biggest, I'll call it opener, from my perspective, is if they have kept doing the same thing and are getting really bad results. So the real indicator, getting very concrete, is that their R&D costs keep rising, right? And their return keeps them flat or lower. So they keep spending more here and they're getting less results. And they keep focusing on optimizing this same model. And the model is broken. In many cases, their category has become commoditized or someone else has disrupted it and they can't even begin to say that, right? If you were AT&T or Vodafone, for example, you would never see Skype coming, right? Because they didn't have the infrastructure costs that you did. They're outside of your mental model, to use an example. Or if you're Afrin, the nasal spray, and private label is completely commoditized, you at Shell, what do? You know, you're in a predicament, which is a problem without a solution. Therefore, the old methods don't work anymore. So that's an example of how I would begin that conversation.
I'm sure that you've worked with many companies, especially in your own region in the southern United States, but around the rest of the world as well. I'm sure you've got some great war stories, or as we call them, case studies, of how a particular company had a challenge and how you then help them through an innovation process to get to a better solution. Have you got one that you'd like to share with us?
Certainly. So first, I'm going to bore everybody with a quick story about our brand and our name, and then I'll get to the case study with your permission, of course. So this Southern Growth Studio, by name, by brand, was intended to take all of the innovation methods, some of the management consulting methods, and some of the growth strategy methods, take this particular fusion, and we were going to focus on our own postage stamp of the world, kind of the tri-state area we are, where we are. So we went, knocked on every door in Tennessee, Arkansas, and Mississippi, every privately owned company, and said, we have the right medicine to help you grow. You could be great, right? We went to cosmetics companies, said, you can compete with L'Oreal, right? But what we found was that these privately held companies at that point were almost allergic to growth. We certainly got a few as clients and they've done well, but we had to go out of market and apply what we call the Beatles strategy. So we had to leave our own Liverpool and go to Hamburg to build a reputation and be popular in our hometown again. So we ended up doing something we said we would never do, which is working with Fortune 500 companies and others and working all over the globe, right? So with that, after successfully finding one of those local companies, they were in Jackson, Mississippi, and we applied this particular medicine, they ended up doubling their revenue in 18 months, right? 18 months. They'd been around 10 years before. They doubled their revenue in 18 months, and they sold for 5x the investment. The lead investor, however, was also invested in this other business that had that same predicament I was talking about, right? Costs are going up, returns are going down. And this was the Jack Nicklaus business, the golfer. Jack and his team have been long-term clients with the studio now. And it was fascinating. So I would like to talk about Jack Nicklaus' case, if that's okay with you.
I'd love that. It's always nice to have a non-corporate sort of obvious example.
Certainly. So at this time, which was at the time of the subprime mortgage meltdown, golf in general was declining in the U.S., but growing in a few other markets. And somewhere along the way, the Jack Nicklaus brand was starting to erode, and they couldn't figure out why. And they wanted to use some innovation methods to figure out what's happening, who are we, and what levers can we change to really, really galvanize our growth. And so we applied the whole method of what we do. And this methodology is a mix of design thinking and some more traditional growth strategy. So we mix insight level data with secondary level data and even some business development to come up with the solution. So it's what we would call a hybrid strategy and innovation project. So first, we went out, and we went out and talked to a little bit more than 200 avid and core golfers. And that was amazing, right? We also went and played golf, everyone but me. You could take one look at me and see I'm not very coordinated. But we played at private courses, public courses in other countries, some of the really renowned courses. We also went shopping at private golf, exclusive golf clubs, at some of the mass stores and just other general sports stores or sporting good divisions in mass stores and online. Then we went to a lot of conferences, PGA conferences. We talked to industry analysts at ESPN and other places, and we talked to some lifestyle brand experts. So that was our primary research ethnographic lens, so to speak. But what we found were more of the human side of the stories. I was in Manhattan talking to a hedge fund trader. This sort of guy that, he's not prone to emotion, right? He's all numbers. His life is a spreadsheet. And he broke down crying over lunch with me, saying he hopes and prays, his language, his son takes up golf, because that's the only place where the rules still apply. Whatever that means, where the rules still apply. So I said, ask him, what do you mean by that? He said, well, in the world of business, or just the world in general, it's not a very honorable place, right? People break their word all the time. But in golf, you live or die by your word. So that sparked something of interest to me. We also started doing all this secondary data. So outside of the 200 conversations we had, we started looking at markets where golf was growing. We surveyed about 4,000 avid core golfers in various markets to see if it dovetailed with the primary market research. And some statistics came up that were really interesting, and that was that marriage rates spoke strongly about the world of golf. And we noticed this one datum in particular where, if you look at the world of basketball, about 17% of avid and core amateur basketball players are married to their original spouse. Right? You think of someone like Dennis Rodman, who had an affair with Madonna, had more than 20 children, many wives, some children out of wedlock. Nobody cares in that world. Right? And then if you look at the world of golf, what happens if a celebrity golfer has an affair? And I'll just put up the example of Tiger Woods, right? Suddenly you have a riot on your hands. He loses all of his endorsement deals. His game starts to suffer. The golfing community is really outraged. So we saw that in the world of golf, 87% of golfers were married, not only married, but married to their original or first spouse. So we came up with it was an insight, obviously, but we came up with a saying in our war room, which was, families that tolerate golf stay together. Now, we also noticed in our ethnography work that the prediction of the PGA was not true. So women are not the savior of golf in the U.S. In fact, they were staying about the same. And men and women don't tend to play together, even if they ride together in those blue buggies, right? It really was more of a man's world, which was interesting unto itself. So then if you couple that with the conversation, it's a place where the rules still apply. And then we found this really interesting Google algorithm that was floating around. What would Jack Nicklaus do if he were a mortgage trader at the time of the subprime meltdown? Now, previously, Jack was very well known for keeping his company from falling into bankruptcy. He personally testified, I will not allow this to go into bankruptcy. And then, so these people are saying, what would Jack do in this situation? So Jack's brand then became part of this avatar for where the rules still apply, right? But then you start looking at the psychographics of where golf is growing, and it gets even more interesting. So we're peeling layer under layer under layer. We're just in the insights generating process. We're not in the value generating process yet. Keep that in mind. This will be the last insight I share of many for this tale. And this is, you see that golf is growing in China, in Malaysia, South Korea. You see it's growing in Russia. You see it's growing in Brazil. And then you just think, well, in the U.S., it's typically males, and these males, in the conversations we have, 200 plus, and then the surveys, on top of that, we have the males pick their favorite non-athletic lifestyle brands. And to a T, it was something very clubby, right? It was either Brooks Brothers or Polo. Also, we found out most belong to private country clubs. Some of them have homes in these clubs. And so what we saw after deducing what the hedge fund trader said and many others started saying behind it, and this perception of lifestyle, and this became one of the other driving insights, is that golf is not a sport, but rather it's a crucible for civilizing young men, right? It's for teaching the rules of the road to those who want to be part of the patriarchy, and in fact, it's the patriarchy's last stronghold in the world, right? Because all the cultures, you either have the very machismo Latin American cultures, the very patriarchal East or Russia, where it's growing. And here in the U.S., it's the male-dominated world of country club. And believe me, we talk to a lot of these people, and I'm not being sexist. The women in that world like it that way very much. They want to be part of that paradigm, part of that club, and in that role. In fact, they want to buy for men in that role, which leads us to the point where the insights actually get some business value. So first and foremost, we found out what the brand of Jack really meant. Jack was well known for, after winning a Masters championship, shaking hands with everybody, being very grateful, but having to excuse himself because he had to go to Little Jackie's Little League game, right? He was a family man. He was the avatar of this patriarchal world we're talking about. But also, golf in all the emerging markets and in its core markets is a place where once you learn these rules, where the rules still apply, you become a civilized young man, that you're able to then ascend the socioeconomic ladder, and you can have this achievable sense of luxury. So this isn't blue blood luxury that's handed down with generational wealth, but if you focus like Jack, just a guy from the Midwest of the United States of America, you have your mental game, you don't get into peccadillos like Tiger, right? You stay true to these values, you're likely to ascend in the world. And that became the mythos of the mind of our prospects. And that also became the brand essence of what he is, the greatest golfer, but he also is the greatest man in that world. And he's seen, again, as that icon or avatar of that world. Now, we did have a massive creative restraint for this business. They didn't have any money to develop new products, right? So they were in the licensing business, they were in the partnership business, they had some products, but they had them in the wrong channel, channels in fact that were eroding their brand. So they had golf clubs in Costco at the time. And believe me, that's a club store for those who don't know that. And having low-priced, okay, pretty good quality golf clubs in a club store does not equal greatness, right? So suddenly we said, take those out. They had rugs and crystals at Lowe's, which is another general big box store. That did not equal the brand. So the first thing we did is we did an overall inventory of what products, services, and licensing deals we should get out of those that are hurting brand equity. And they did. Surprisingly, not all clients take our advice, but they were in a position to do so, and they did. But then, looking at all the secondary and primary data, we built this big model, and we saw that a very large percentage, almost 90% of avid and core golfers also are avid grillers. And then we did a brand match. We looked at the values of Jack, as we had talked about, and we built up this whole matrix in this model where we were able to find companies that could meet them and co-develop products. But I don't know if you've seen or not, but it's a very successful Sub-Zero Wolf Jack Nicklaus outdoor kitchen line. Right? And then we saw a large percent, about 76%, also fly fish. So we're able to set up meetings with Orvis, right? All the way down to the 3% that do Taekwondo or the 2% that also do yoga where we didn't activate. If you fast forward, their business has grown, their organization has been transformed. They were able to take the insights and the re-articulation of the brand and sell naming rights to a building in China for 3x what their revenue was the past 2 years immediately. And then get into some of these business development and product development partnerships that have been able to not only sustain but grow their business.
I think it's one of the most fascinating innovation examples that I've heard in a long time because it's just so, it's out of the ordinary, you describe it. It's not like you usually describe a sports personality without any products of their own to require innovative thinking, but it's just a perfect example of how if you go out and you get the right insights, you can innovate in just about any market.
That is the key thing, finding the right insights and really wrestling with those insights till you know they're of unique value. And with that, I would just want to give a warning, which is the insights have to not only be true in the market, but they also have to be true to the product, brand, or service suite that you're looking at. So it has to be kind of true and open in the market, but also resonate with the DNA of whatever organization it's representing. And it did. That's the intersection you're looking for, where it meets with, here's the consumer insight, in this case, the player insight, and here's the business opportunity and business strategy. So.
How long did it actually take you to go out and get these insights? Because I know a lot of companies, they think innovation as a process starts and ends in a two-hour brainstorming session.
This was actually a rather quick project for us, and it was about 3 months. But if you think about something that has the power to transform an entire business, a three-month investment is worth the time, right? It's not that long, quarter.
Absolutely. I mean, the alternative is to just keep plodding along and losing business for 6 months, a year, 2 years.
That's right.
Michael, it's been wonderful having you here. We're coming up to the end of the interview, but if you could leave one actionable piece of insight or a tip with our audience on how they can get more value out of their innovation efforts, what would it be?
I would say embed the outside into the inside. And what I mean is you first have to leave the building, right? Go and figure out where the customer or consumer pains really are. And don't just think about it, don't Google about it, but really go live with these people. So leave your building, but then find a way to dramatize and get into storytelling around those insights and make it real and palpable inside the company as well, right? So you become the carrier of these insights and that everyone gets focused on solving real problems for real people.
And we're also going to get all of the links to your resources down in the video description below. Could you just describe where those links are going to take people and what they can expect to find there?
Certainly. So you'll come to the company's website, which is a Southern Growth Studio, and you'll be able to see everything we do in more color. There's also MichaelGraberInnovations.com, and that has all of the pieces that I write for Inc. magazine, for Innovation Excellence, many of which have been compiled in this book. Sorry for the product placement. But, and you can order the book or the ebook there as well. And then I would invite any of your listeners to LinkedIn with me, Facebook with me, however.
It's been wonderful having you here, and I look forward to speaking again with you soon.
Thank you for all the work you do in the world. Thank you.
Congratulations on being part of the Innovation and Creativity Summit. I'm sure that if you continue to watch the other expert interviews, you will experience an improvement in your capability to turn your ideas into something valuable. But don't forget, to get the very best experience and ensure you don't miss any of the priceless lessons, you should invest in yourself with the All Access Pass. Not only will this give you exclusive lifetime access to watch all the lessons whenever is best for you, you will also get all the interviews as downloadable audio files so you can learn on the go, full transcripts so you can read and analyze the great advice and tips, and exclusive bonuses not available to anyone else. Click the link below to get your All Access Pass now.